ready, the spokesman of God will begin. We started last time trying to set a particular stage for today, a sequence of three presentations that in a certain way tie in with what else is the other things that are going on in the village right now. And we talked about Adam and the curse. We looked at the nature of man and the question of his identity and character and relationship to the ground, and that man is inevitably bound to the ground in one way or another for his existence. And in order to sort of recapture some of that, I want to tell you an American Indian myth. One of the most important things in my recent studies about creation stories and the like, and stories of throughout the Bible really, is to see similar stories about the origins of things in other religions and other peoples around the world. And the more you study these, the more you begin to appreciate the full impact of the biblical stories. And there are many, many stories about the creation of man that are very similar to the biblical one, not identical by any means, but some of the same sensitivities are apparent. And I would like to tell you one about the American Indian myth. The Zuni Indians tell, and it reveals a sensitivity to the character of man and his bond with nature that many of us have lost, and which is really present in the biblical text, but because of our abuse of the text, we have lost some of that, most of it. The story is really a long one, but I want to tell you the ending of it. The story is a long one about how man evolved from lower forms of nature through various stages, the red and the blue and the green and the black regions of existence. And as he moved up, he changed from grasshopper into whatever, until the final stage. And he moved into the last realm, and he was there present in the land where the gods are. And the gods decided that this creature that had so far evolved was still not really a man, because it had claws and a number of other deficiencies yet that were not characteristic. And so they said, let's make a man that is, despite all of this process of moving through these stages, that is like us. Kind of common refrain you've heard before. And when they did this, they took 2 ears of corn. One ear of corn was yellow and the other ear of corn was white. Of course, corn represents that which is staple to their existence, to their diet, to their lifestyle. Just as in another culture it might have been wheat, or it might have been a garden like you've got in Genesis 2 and the ground. 2 ears of corn were placed between 2 buckskins, which of course are likewise part of their culture. And then they danced around it and said certain words of faith, and the wind began to blow. The breath, the spirit, just the same as the breath and the spirit came to the ground and created man in Genesis 2. And it says then that the wind blew through the 2 buckskins, and finally there was movement. And when they removed the buckskin on top, there was man, and there was woman. And then the comment is made, if you look at the tips of your fingers, you can see the traces of the wind of the great spirit that created you, just as he created your forefathers. I don't recall any story that has a greater sensitivity to the very tips of your fingers of being created by the Spirit of God in any culture. Your fingerprints, which have been pushed into the paper by the oppressive powers of our society, are for them the symbol of the creative forces of God. And the Genesis 2 story is really very close to this, in the sense that the Spirit of God is the life force that moves in the clay, which is you, to give you life. And because of man having violated his relationship with God, the curse has entered so that the clay is no longer always a happy relationship with God. The violated relationship between man and the ground is one that has to be overcome by some other force. Curse is the evil force that's at work in the world. This is the language of Genesis to describe that evil force at work in the world. And the power, some other power, has to be introduced by God to overcome that force, that negative force, the chaos, the evil force at work in the world. And the way that this is done is through the figure, first in this particular sequence we're doing now, the figure of Abraham. To set the stage for Abraham one more step, the story that precedes the Abraham accounts and the promises of Abraham and what they're all about is a story of the Tower of Babel, which is a beautiful piece of satire. At the end, after all mankind had once again multiplied after the flood, and all of mankind decides to come to one place, and they have the fortune in those days of having one language. And when they come to this one place, they have a great desire, it says in chapter 11. Let me read the text. Come, let us build ourselves a city, verse 4, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad. Make a name for yourself means to gain identity, to become, in this text, truly somebody important, someone who will be able to stand up and control things, in this text. And then the Lord came down to see. You have to understand what those words mean. Apparently they start building this huge tower. And God is sitting up down there, and he looks down and he says, well, it's something going on down there, but it's so far down and it's so small, I'm going to have to go down and take a look. The irony of God, of somebody who wants to storm the heavens and is really so far away that God can hardly see it and must come down. And throughout the Genesis story, you've got God always coming down to find out, as though he doesn't really know. He asks questions, well, Adam, where are you? You've got the God who continually moves into the scene to find out and to be with and to struggle with man in the midst of the curse, man under the curse. And he makes a strange statement as to why the curse of the Tower of Babel happened. Very strange statement. Behold, they are one people and they have one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing they propose will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse them. So the Lord scattered them across the face of the earth. It's interesting. It's as though there's always the potential in man to storm the heavens. The same thing was said after the story, after the first fall. We'll have to put man outside of the garden, lest man, who be is a now a sinner and has violated the relationship with God, will become an eternal problem up here. And so now there's this phenomenal potential that is always recognized in, not simply the phenomenal evil in man, but the phenomenal potential of man to somehow or another storm God and want to try and take over instead of God being in control. And that is the principle whereby another curse is set at motion, namely the curse of different languages because of the nature of man. Now remember that all of the chapters of Genesis 1 to 11 precede the great promise. And so they are all pictures of the world in a certain sense that has undergone certain curses. And one of them, in a sense, is the fact that we do have different languages and do not communicate. Then comes the figure of Abraham. It is onto that scene that the function of the promise and the role of the promise must be seen against the world of mankind who is under the curse. I want to pause periodically. I'm doing a lot of talking, mostly in Bible class. At home we go more slowly and I let you fire questions back. Any questions that some of you have about the setup? All right. Let me ask one question as I go into this. If I say, what is a promise? A very simple English word that we use. And I'm using that word because this is the word of the biblical word rather than some of the other words. What does the word promise mean to you? When I say the word promise, what does it mean? Agreement.
Pledge.
A contract. That's very interesting that we've got agreement and contract as two definitions of the word promise. If I say to you, she's not even looking there. If I say to you, I promise you something, what does that mean to you?
I shall do what you please.
All right.
I don't have to wait for you to do it, I know you do it.
You'll know I do it. I may be a schnook. But you assume that when somebody promises that they'll do it. What is it, what else does a promise mean for you? It's very interesting that somebody said contract.
Affirmation
of intent. Is promise ever a negative word?
Threat.
Promise is a threat?
Promise you all.
But are you using word promise in its true sense there? I promise you I'll get you sometime. Is that a promise? Is that a real promise or is that something else? You're using the word promise in a derisive and non-genuine sense of the word. You're saying, I have a very violent intent to do something to you, which is not what a promise is. I think, you see, that's the what happens in the English language sometimes. We take a word out of one context and its original intentionality is transferred to another context. That, I don't think, is a genuine use of the word promise. We've used it that way, but I think it's not the way normally. That's very interesting. We have a great variety of meanings, and in a certain sense that's helpful later on. But I would say that if I got to say, I say to Dick, look, I promise you, Dick, that I will always show you my love. What does that imply? It's a gift, all right?
A vow.
A word, yes, it's a word. Above all, a promise has a word dimension to it, doesn't it? It has a giving dimension. It has a word dimension. What else does that have? It implies a receiver. It implies it's a relational word, right? You need a receiver. I don't just go out there and say, I promise that I will sing, you know. When you normally use the word promise, you say it to somebody. It implies a receiver. Very good. So there are three things. What else? And it's positive. Huh? That whatever I do will be somehow or another be implemented. It will not simply be a static word. It's a word that implies a continuous action in relationship.
Something you'll be held to.
Something, but not held to by any threat. Held to by what? Yeah? By your integrity. By your integrity. Not by some kind of law that is imposed upon you. Now, it's a word, it's a relational thing, it's an outreach, it's a gift. Always implies outreaching. When I promise somebody, that's something from me reaching out to that person. And it implies that somehow the future can be, you can base certain things on that in the future in terms of who we are and what we will do. If I make a promise that certain actions in the future, it's always directed towards the future. It's not simply something directed to the past. But if I'm going to have a promise that means anything, I could be anybody. You don't know who I am. It could be just a plain schnook or a fink, whatever. And my promise may not have any validity because you don't have a prior trust relationship. A promise that is going to be dependent upon normally implies not only a receiver, but some kind of prior relationship that enables it to be effective. Well, those things are helpful for us to see what the word promise is all about. I say that because in the whole Lutheran tradition, we've lost it somewhat, but if you ever read the Lutheran confessions, The word that is used for gospel more often than any other word is the word promise. And that's a very positive word. Good news is sort of just an announcement often. But promise has a lot more going for it than simply news. I get news on Sunday and it just simply is announced to the world. But a promise is a relational thing between me and you, between God and his people. And so when you start to look at the question of the promise in Abraham, you've got what is virtually the Old Testament equivalent. It is, not virtually, but it is the Old Testament equivalent to the gospel. And what that's all about. And Paul makes that very explicit in Galatians. So when I look at this promise, I say, all right, what is there in the promise, in the character of the promise, that is really important? First, and the promise comes in chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. And the promise comes with a specific content and word, but also implying all of these other things that we've just said about what a promise is. Promise is, now, Abraham, and the Lord said to Abraham, go from your country and from your kindred and your father's house. So there's a prior act, there's a prior thing that Abraham does, an act of faith that precedes the actual words of promise. Now that act of faith is an extraordinarily important one. What does it mean when Abraham goes from his land? Where did he live? Does anyone know? Well, that's all right. Ur of the Chaldees, all right. Anybody know anything about Ur? Ur simply happens to be one of the most highly civilized communities of the ancient world. Abraham is not going from some schnooky place. He's leaving New York City to go to Nebraska or something like that. He is leaving New York City. He's leaving the highly civilized culture of his time, or Paris or wherever you like, Rome, to go and live out in a miserable place. And God says, I'll show you where to go. So he packs up his bags, like any number of hitchhikers of the ancient world, packs up his donkey and with his kids and everything, and leaves Ur of the Chaldees. I mean, you and I would say that there's just nothing sensible about that, excepting that in some sense there is the hearing of faith that in order for me to gain an identity of who I am and what my future and destiny is, I must leave this culture, I must leave this world and simply go. And God will show me who I am in the process. Now, he goes from Ur of the Chaldees and he ends up at a place called Canaan, which is really a miserable piece of land when all is said and done. Now, the Jewish people have done quite a lot to that piece of land so that it looks a lot different than it did a few years ago. But it was nothing to write home to Ur of the Chaldees about. And he didn't. When he gets there, God puts a finger on him and says, all right, now this is the promise. This is the land, which Abraham quit several times because he couldn't stand it. But anyway, this is the land. I promise you this will be your land. It's the first thing. There are four parts to this, four content elements to the promise. But initially, it depends upon the relationship. And these are contents, they are gifts, but immediately you say they are gifts, they're also something else. The four things are a land, and he says, and I will make you a great nation and bless you and give you a great name. Somehow or another, he is going to get a name. It stands in antithesis to the people in the great Tower of Babel story who said they were going to make their own name. God says, I am going to give you a name. Just a word about name. To have a name means to have identity. In the ancient world, the stories of creation talk about the fact when so-and-so and so-and-so was not yet named. That meant when they had not yet really come into existence. When Adam names the animals, he gives them identity and character. The story here is the story about Abraham's identity, and every Israelite who reads this story and listens to it, here's the whole idea of their own identification, their own growth, their own understanding of who they are. You live through the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or of Israel, and you become that same people. You become one of Israel. Just as you learn certain stories which are part of your self-identifying, your makeup as to who you are. The name. The third thing that is here is that in some way or another there will be progeny and seed. So we had one, land, two, great name or nation, and three, progeny, seed. In order for this to happen, there has to be children. There has to be seed. There has to be a kind of perpetuation of yourself in your progeny, in your follow, in your tribe. Now, seed doesn't always mean just simply somebody who comes out of your loins, but that's the primary accent. And then comes the fourth promise, the fourth element of the promise. And it is really only one of the traditions that has this, but it's a very important one. And it's really crucial. What is the nature of the promise over against everything that happened before this time in history in the portrait of Genesis? It says, whoever you bless, I will bless. Whoever you curse, I will curse. And through you, all families of the, I'll repeat a Hebrew word, see if you remember it, Adamah will be blessed. What was the Adamah? Right. So the Adamah that was cursed because of Adam, now the process is to be reversed. The function of Abraham is not merely to get all these good things, you see. Not all these great promises of goodness and greatness and name and lots of kids running around. But above all, that he is to be the vehicle of freedom, of salvation, of identity, of liberation, whatever terms you want to use, the power at work to counter all the curses that had been imposed upon man because of what man had done. That's the gospel, you see. That's the gospel in Abraham language, that he is to be the vehicle of liberation, the vehicle of blessing. Blessing in the ancient world is a word that means that you get life power to be able to overcome the negative life powers at work. And blessing is a word that doesn't just mean spiritual kind of gifts. Blessing means the whole ramification, the whole package of what's going on in your life. One of the great blessings that you have, you see, is the lovely eyes you have. And it's part of your blessing as a being. And you, in a sense, have that whole person, that whole being, to be used in bringing blessing and meaning and purpose to others. It's not simply some kind of word that I say, or I'll tell you about Jesus. It's you. Abraham and his people are to be the blessing factor. And the blessing factor for the whole of life, not merely for some spiritual corner of it. And the curse, you see, that we looked at before was far more than simply thistles on the ground. It was violated relationships of all kinds and shapes. And those are to be overcome. And the one that I mentioned that's very overt is, of course, the subjugation of women. And that's another one of the ones, that curses that is to be overcome through the power of blessing, through the promise. And these may be new words, but they are the Old Testament words which, in a sense, helpfully will bring alive the meaning and the function of gospel that is a little broader than some of the simplistic descriptions that we tend to get. I'm going to pause there. Now, I can go on, you know, with the lectures forever on Abraham, so I'm just going to try and select some of the key things that follow from this. The first thing that happens after Abraham gets the promise in chapter 12, at the end of chapter 12, starting with verse 10, the first thing that happens is a famine. And good old Abraham simply can't take it. You know, a famine in Canaan is much like a great winter of snow in Nebraska, where it's just nothing. And what happens in all the stories that follows is that you see Abraham struggling with this promise and really trying to believe that God would ever do such a thing. You know, it's just impossible to go to this impossible land with this kind of impossible promise when you're just a man and a few other people to gain the blessing and change the world. How asinine can you be, God? Ask me to change all these other communities. And so the portrait that follows is the portrait of how Abraham relates to the promise. His doubts and his affirmations. And the first thing that happens is that he chickens out. As soon as there's a famine, he runs to the nearest civilization, which is Egypt, right? Sure. Big civilization. They got lots of wheat down there. They're organized. You know, they got an establishment, but there's nothing in Canaan. So he runs down to Egypt. Once he gets there, he does one of the dirtiest things that you could imagine. What does he do? And remember that in this portrait of the patriarchs, it's not simply a portrait of the patriarchs as great heroes of faith where we emulate all of their good things. You understand their humanness and their sinfulness and their dirty deeds rather forcefully as you listen to it. They are not whitewashed. They are in our Sunday school books, but they are not in the Bible. They are not whitewashed. And Abraham's first thing is to have this lovely little statement. Just listen to this statement. Because Sarah, you remember, is very beautiful at this stage. She is not yet that 100-year-old cracker that you get later on. She is a very beautiful, lusty woman. And there are lots of very powerful pictures, stories, traditions of it, just how beautiful Sarah is, you know. The descriptions of her from the tips of her fingers to the tips of her toes is something else. But here she's simply described as beautiful. Just take it for what it's worth. Now listen to what Abraham says to Sarah. The illustration of the man who is supposed to have the promise and all of the future in his hands, and this is what he does. I know you're a beautiful woman, beautiful to behold, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, and they will let you live. Now, who's Abraham thinking about? All right. Now, he's, say you're my sister, honey. Say you're my sister, so that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared on your account. You do this great heroic deed. Sarah is put up to it. Now, that's a chauvinist of the first order there. It's an extraordinary thing. Abraham clearly is not to be whitewashed. He has done a deed that is beyond consideration, the ancient world or the present world, that you give somebody else your wife to save your own neck. And the only way the thing is solved is by God coming in and bringing plagues on Pharaoh. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Abraham is rescued from the Egyptians by plagues because of Israel's sins there, namely Abraham's sin. And this story is a prototype of the whole later picture of the rescue. You tell this story in the light of the subsequent Exodus event. And they get out of there by the skin of their teeth, but don't whitewash it. She really was his wife, Pharaoh's wife. This woman who is the mother of the people of God is someone who had been manhandled by the Egyptians. No two ways about it. And yet the promise goes on, you see. That's the whole point of the Genesis patriarchal stories, that of all of the dastardly things that these stinkers do, the promise goes on. And the promise is that you're supposed to bring blessing to these people. Wasn't a lot of blessing to the Egyptians the first time around, and it wasn't a lot the second time around either, for that matter. But that's what they're supposed to be doing. That's what the responsibility of the promise involves. You have the blessing power. What are you doing with it? Let me take a couple of other stories to illustrate my point. We don't have that much time. The second time around, chapter 15. First verses of chapter 15. Abraham is by now an old man, and he says, you know, really, God's not doing a darn thing to fulfill his part of the promise. He's not doing anything. Here we are, old crackers, my wife and I, no children. There's only one solution. And he tries two different ways. And that is that I have to do it myself somehow, get this promise going. How can I have progeny without children, you know? Seed. And all these promises can't be fulfilled. So he tries two different ways. One is to have a little fun with Hagar, his other wife, which is not the legitimate line. And God says, no, I don't buy that. And then he says in chapter 15, tell you what, God, there's a good custom we have in this part of the world where I'll make the head of my household, the head of the servants of the household, to be the legitimate adopted son. I will adopt a son, make the head of the household, his name is Eliezer, in chapter 15, verse 2, to be the heir. And we'll have children through him. It's a total act of unfaith, a total act of distrust in the promises. Abraham mistrusted again and again and again, and so did Sarah. Doubly bad, as a matter of fact. We'll come to that in a moment. But the point is, you have a promise at work, and you get a very realistic picture of the problem of relating to a promise that is ridiculous. And in a certain sense, the promise of the gospel we hear, if you hear it in these terms, is likewise an impossible thing to believe, and you require a heck of a lot of struggle to be able to believe it. You will doubt it again and again that there is any power in the gospel to change anything. And so it is with this promise. So God says, look, I'd like to take you outside with Larry Collins and look at the stars. The word of the Lord came and says, this man shall not be your heir, but your own son. And the man is now almost 80 years old. Look at the heavens and see all the stars. Your children will be as many as the stars. Then comes this very famous line. Abraham believed in God and it was counted to him. Reckoned to him for righteousness. Paul makes a lot of that, Luther makes a lot of that, and justly so. The act of Abraham was simply to say, well, I'll put it in your hands, God. Normally, to be reckoned righteous, that expression is a technical expression. To be reckoned righteous comes out of the cult, where if you had done the right things and done the right sacrifices and carefully prayed the right prayers, you would, by the priests, be reckoned righteous and acceptable and able to worship. Now, in this text, in this particular text, the accent is on the fact that he simply believed. He simply trusted God's promise. Sure, he'll doubt it again tomorrow, but at that point, the fact that he had believed that promise, that impossible promise as an old man that there would be his own son and seed, that's the ground upon which the relationship of promise perpetuates and continues. And that's what Paul is talking about when he says that that promise came long before the law. And the relationship to that promise can only be one of trusting the other party. Not just trusting the words, trusting the party. When somebody makes a promise and you believe, I trust the promise. I'll trust the promise a lot easier than I will a lot of other things. And it's not really, therefore, a contract. Only indirectly can you use that expression. It's more that word, or if you will, the word we trust because we trust the person. Now, you've got to get to the climax of this thing where they finally do get the child. Otherwise, it's not a fair morning. You've got to get to the classic text. And the classic text is in chapter 18, where the promise finally is first indicated that it's going to be fulfilled, where the child is actually to be born. Now this text puts Abraham in a slightly better light, but it's also a difficult text to swallow if you listen to it. What happens in chapter 18? And I really think you ought to almost be, you know, one ought to also almost be right out there in the desert to feel this. If you want to read along, you can. I've learnt this one just about by heart. It's one of the great texts of the whole of Pentateuch. Abraham sitting in the desert. It's in the middle of the day. Hot as can possibly be. At that time of the day, nobody goes. Nobody walks. And as he's sitting there, this old man of 100 or 99, old man of 99 is sitting there in a desert, snoozing away, and all of a sudden, he blinks his eyes, and out of the desert, burning sand, comes three men. That's ridiculous to start with. Something odd about three men who walk across the desert sand in the middle of the day. Abraham doesn't know who they are, but being a truly hospitable old dingling from the desert, he gets up. And if you listen to the words of that text, every time Abraham does something, he runs. So you have to picture an old man running every inch of the way, everything. This thing is very subtly and beautifully worded. This funny old man is running every inch of the way. He runs out to meet them and falls on his face and says, if I find grace in your eyes, why don't you come and have a meal with me? He says, let's have a spot of food and a morsel and a little bit of water for your feet. Total understatement. It's like the English, you know, when you say have a spot of tea. And you know, the whole thing is laid out with cream and tea and cakes and cookies and the like. What he does is to bring them a regular banquet. A banquet in the middle of the desert. He first of all goes and gets water for their feet. And when he says, let me do all these things for you, you know, they just sort of say, okay, okay. And you wonder who they are, you know, Americans abroad. And so Abraham goes like fury doing all these things for these people as the super host, the perfect host. He gets a little bit of food. No, he gets up, kills the calf. He runs out and has his servant kill the calf, and he gives an order to Sarah, 3 pancakes to stay, you know. Short order cooked there. And the whole thing is prepared, and they not only just have milk, they have milk and curds and the whole thing. He lays it out, this enormous meal in the middle of the desert in the heat of the day, and steps back and lets them eat it. And then comes the word you never ask, the test of a real host. They say, where's your wife? Now remember, they're living right beside Sodom. And the implications are very obvious. And he says, this old man can't do anything. Anyway, she's in the tent. And this old woman, well, she must have just about burst out. Who the devil would want me? And then they turn the table. Then they reveal that they have a different purpose. That this old woman who is afraid of being raped is the one who's going to receive a child. And that that child is going to be the sign of the promise. And this old woman who at one moment was totally scared down to her toes is at the next moment just exploding. Fancy me, you know, I couldn't possibly have a child. I'm 99. The old man's no better. And she laughs just like you do. And then so the man says, well, Sarah laughed. And she says, no, I didn't laugh. So she had lying to laughter. You know, his lying, laughing, doubting old woman is the hero of the promise or the heroine of the promise. She's the one. And so they said, are you laughing? No, I didn't laugh. Yes, you laughed. You know, and the word for laugh is what? Yitzchak. It was word for Isaac. Did you Isaac? No, I didn't Isaac. Yes, you Isaac. And everybody knows that the Isaacing around there was really, the point of it all is to reveal the name of the child Isaac, you see? And so they call the child the laughing one, which is exactly what you're doing, you know? And here's the sign of the ludicrous, ridiculous laughter that you should happen to choose this old woman. And the miracle child is born, and they call him the laughing one. And that's the promise. And that is to be the mediation now of blessing and the power of life to other peoples. That's the promise. And our time is just about up. What I want to do is to take this motif now and ask the question of how in the Exodus, the promise ties up. Now, you can trace the same promise through a lot of other people. With Jacob, Isaac, the laughing and wonder child, turns out to be rather a weakling historically. But his son, Jacob, turns out to be not a weakling, but a fink. Through whom the promise likewise is perpetuated by the grace of God. Abraham is a doubting, doddering old man who can put on a good meal, but really doesn't quite get all of the things that's going on. Isaac is a kind of a weak shadow of Abraham, but Jacob is a stinker who knows what's going on, and he's taking advantage of it. And it really requires a whole lesson on Jacob as a separate character. And about just one little footnote, the whole picture of his birth is the picture of what Jacob's all about. If Isaac means the laughing one, Jacob means the one who grabs by the heel. And if you remember the earlier versions of what the heel is a euphemism for, you understand that he truly has a particular character. And it is this figure that God uses, the sinner, the deceiver, and yet the one through whom God will work his plan. And the promise works through these patriarchal figures. Maybe I'll pick up one story on Jacob tomorrow, on Friday morning, to lead in to the Exodus story. This is the promise. The promise that is to set at work the power, one, to give Israel its own identity as a people through the patriarchs, and two, to give them the means whereby the curses and evils that work in the world are to be overcome, and that God works such promises. And Isaac, the laughing child, the wonder child, is the sign, the symbol of that gospel as it begins to work in the world. We'll see you tomorrow.